Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We have a special guest with us tonight, Dr. Nov Kashyap, who is an expert in the art of starting a practice and indeed helping dentists transition to ownership. Nov, thanks so much for coming along tonight. It's great to have you.
Thanks, Jesse. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, look, we're going to have a bit of fun tonight. And look, Nov, you're a very well-known figure in the dental community, certently in Australia and New Zealand. You're a regular poster in the forums of DPR and DPO and others. And so there'll be a lot of listeners who are familiar with you, but there'll be equally some new listeners who aren't familiar with you and your story. So I was wondering, mate, if you wouldn't mind just sharing a little bit of your story with us. And for those who don't know, Nov has started 11 practices, which is phenomenal. That is a phenomenal record. There's not too many people I can think of who would have done more than that. So, Matt, I was wondering if you wouldn't mind just giving a little bit about your background, telling us a little bit about your story, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, no, sure, Jesse. I guess it all started when I graduated from dentistry back in 2006. I had a year of working as a dentist, and it was always the plan to do medicine following dentistry and get into surgery and the rest of it. But I enjoyed my first year of working. I did a lot of surgery with, as you know, I do a lot of wisdom teeth surgery. And so, you know, I decided to stick with dentistry, and then we had the opportunity to buy a practice quite early on in my career, which I did. I saw a lot of opportunity and I kind of capitalized on it. And then, from there, from my first practice, it was quite a few years before the second practice started. But once systems were established and I had a really good cash flow with those first two practices, then, you know, from number three to number 11 was quite a quick process. So I guess, yeah, the key thing there for me was establishing a good base initially. And once that base was established, then it really did become a lot easier to do certain things and expand rapidly, I guess. So, yeah.
Fantastic. So, Nov, as you've gone through this journey, has there been any kind of underlying philosophy that's guided your decision-making process around this? Has there been an overarching plan? Did you begin with the end in mind, so to speak, or has it been something that's evolved naturally?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I do get asked this a little bit, but for me, I can't honestly say that I began with the end in mind. You know, there was no way, if someone had told me back in 2008 when I bought my first practice that 2015, I'd have started 11. I don't think there's any way that I would have believed them. So in that respect, no, but there was a lot of things that I did, I guess, by chance that really helped set me up for that level of growth. And I think the major thing was that I was very pro-delegation from the beginning. There was a lot of things in my practices I didn't know how to do. I left it to a practice manager that I really trusted, and that freed up a lot of my time to look for startup locations and set the strategic direction for the group. And I think, that obviously helped. But at the start, it wasn't like I was actively thinking, if I delegate everything and be completely hands-off, then I'll be able to grow quite rapidly. It kind of was a function of how I set out to do things at the beginning.
That's a really interesting point, though, because that's a bit counterintuitive for most dentists, because most dentists tend to like to be in control of a lot of things. And what I'm hearing you say is you consciously gave up control of certain elements of your practice so that you could focus in other areas. Am I interpreting that correctly?
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, I've always been one to focus on my strengths, and my strengths aren't clinical dentistry other than surgery. So, obviously I enjoy wisdom teeth. I've had a lot of training, do them to quite a high level. But there's a lot of administrative tasks, a lot of bookkeeping, a lot of things like that that have never been my strength and never will be. So, I guess marketing is a strength of mine because I enjoy it and I do a bit of research into it. So I've really tried to focus on my strengths, whereas I've outsourced a lot of my weaknesses, and I think, that's helped a bit along the way.
I think that's a massive insight there for anyone listening, is, making sure that, you're playing to your strengths. And again, Nov, I'd be interested to know, I'm sure that's a philosophy that's gone through your organisation, as well as putting people in roles that play to their strengths, if I'm assuming that. Am I correct in assuming that?
Yeah, well, you know, from a clinical level, a great example of that is our model is very different to a lot of conventional dental practices out there, in that we have pseudo specialists or practitioners with special areas of interest. So, you know, a patient that comes through our surgery could well see a lot of different practitioners. And I mean, there's arguments for and against that kind of thing, but I firmly believe that if you're seeing the best person for a certain procedure, then that's more ideal. You know, we've got a guy that does root canals to a really high level. I do wisdom teeth surgery. We've got a peds dentist and a couple of dentists with peds, a lot of peds experience. So, yeah, that's kind of it is about focusing on the strengths as well, and you know, not so much. I had a lunch with a dentist today, or a dental student today, and he was saying how you know, he's really tried to build up his weaknesses. But for me, it's been about letting go of your weaknesses and focusing on the strengths, and I think that's been a major guiding philosophy. Yeah.
Yeah. Look, I really concur with that, and what I found certainly in my own life as well is the things that I enjoy, I'm generally better at.
Yes.
Because I enjoy it, I put more time and effort into it, and I inherently develop the skills just through interest levels. And like you, there are a lot of things that I'm really lousy at, and I'm more than happy to have those taken off my plate too. As you've gone through this journey, you know, clearly, you know, 11 startups, and you would have learned a thing or two, clearly. What would be... You know, as people are listening here, what would be the number one or two or three things that you think, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, turned out to be boo-boos? Were there any key blunders or key, I suppose, traps for young players in terms of starting a practice?
Yeah, I guess within the context of business and ownership generally, the biggest trap that young owners, I think, get into is the relationship with their staff. You know, often as a young business owner, you have a really young team, and the tendency is there to want to get really close to your team, to socialize with your team, you know, have Friday night drinks and, you know, kick on to a pub and, you know, all that kind of thing. And I think, and, you know, I'm guilty of that. I was guilty of that in the early days. But the problem that that does is it sets it up for a really uncomfortable time when things start to turn around. So when you want to discipline a staff member or have a talk to them about something that they perhaps haven't done the right way or how you'd like them to improve, it's a much more difficult conversation to have with someone who's a friend than someone who is a staff member. So I think it's really important to maintain that sort of boundary. That's been one of the major lessons I've heard, I've sort of developed. And, you know, that was simply by making huge mistakes in that regard early on. But I guess in terms of things that I've done right, I've always, you know, just from a young age, I've always had my parents instill in us that, you know, the philosophy that to build up your own business, you don't have to destroy anyone else's, or in destroying someone else's business, or if you dig someone else's grave, God will have dug your grave ready for you. So I think it's, yeah, a lot of that guides a lot of the principles that I follow. Yeah.
Look, that's a really nice principle. And again, for those who do know, you know, will know that, you know, you're very generous in what you share in various forums and so on. Interestingly enough, just as a small topic, I was talking to a friend of mine, Andrew Griffiths, who, yeah, extraordinarily gifted marketer, extraordinarily gifted public presenter. He's just a really lovely guy. And he and I were having a conversation a little while ago, and we think one of the new currencies is really generosity. And I don't know, do you have a take on that? That's not really a conversation I thought we'd be having tonight, but do you have any views on generosity as currency at all?
Yeah, I have. It's a little philosophical, but I think my view on it is that, you know, as you know, you and I have disagreed previously on the role that luck plays. But for me, I feel like the position I've been in, you know, although I have worked hard and the rest of that, a lot of it has been luck. And, you know, I'm quite, I guess, fortunate to be in the position I am at such an early age. But part of that is also giving back to people who haven't. And I think I take that view when I try to support younger dentists, advocate for younger dentists, you know, help educate younger dentists in the path to transition to ownership. But also, you know, wisdom teeth surgery, I regularly have dentists from the forums come and watch me take wisdom teeth out and that kind of thing. So, and all that is, you know, free of charge. But it's something that, yeah, it's more because I felt like, you know, I've gotten to where I have because of luck and I should give back. give back a little. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's good. And we are going to delve into the role of luck in a minute because I know that's something that you and I do kind of kick around a little bit. So we'll certainly get into that in a moment. Again, just while we're on the startup journey you've had, and you know, one of the one of the most watched speeches you'll see on the internet is Steve Jobs' address to the Stanford Uni graduates. And one of the things he says is you can't connect the dots forward; you can only connect them with the benefit of hindsight and looking backwards. As you look back and connect the dots in your journey, what things do you think you did well? You know, things that you know you might not have known at the time, but things that you know turned out to be masterstrokes.
Yeah, I think, leading on from the point initially, and I won't go back to that, but focusing on my strengths, but an extension to that was really picking well the team that I established around me. So what I found is, one of my major principles in my personal relationships, in my choosing of friends and the rest of that has been honesty. You know, I value honesty above pretty much all else. And I found that I gravitated towards people who valued the same when dealing with business. So, I've got a situation now where if I've found a location for a startup practice, I pretty much pick up the phone for my fit-out guy. Him and I arrange a meeting. We go there. We have 30 minutes to look at the building. I've already done all my research. He measures it out. Within 2 days, he gives me a floor plan. I make any changes I want to make. And then the next time I go to that practice, it's when it's fitted out. And the same thing happens with my equipment guy. You know, we've got a standard order of equipment that we have. So when you can automate it to that level, I put in the time into how much time I look at into a startup. And my personal time is literally between 5 and 10 hours. It's very little. Whereas, the person that's starting their first practice, they have obviously they put in many, many more hours than that. But I think the key thing was because I value honesty, I gravitated towards people that were quite honest, and that was that served me well in the business world. But the lesson, I guess, the greater lesson from that is, and the question you're asking is that you need to do business with people that share the same values that you share. And I think that's helped me a lot along the way because, if someone makes a mistake, anyone I deal with makes a mistake, they're very honest about it. We address it and we move on from it. So, yeah, I think that's been one of the major lessons, I guess, I've learned over the years, and that anyone who's not honest, I cut business ties with them very quickly. I'm just trying to think. In terms of other sort of good things that I've done along the way, I guess I have an appreciation for return on investment and a very strong numbers background. Yeah. And that's helped a lot as well in assessing things in a business sense. So, yeah.
Yeah, okay, cool. I certainly share your love of numbers with you. The other thing I think I share with you as well, and because we've spoken about this in previous conversations, was how systemized your businesses are, and you take a systematic approach to a lot of things that you do. I'm just wondering if you'd be happy to share a bit of insight around the level of systemization that you have and how you went about doing that.
So I think the main things that I have systemized is the process of opening, the process of starting up. Recently ran a seminar on the Gold Coast, and one of the key feedback things I got from participants is how I delivered a recipe, almost a how-to or a checklist of how to transition into ownership. And the big thing was it was a really easy to follow recipe. And I think I've systemized that over the years. You know, we've got people that make our initial stock and equipment order. We've got people that look at our marketing and get our marketing up to date. And everything in the startup process has been systemized to a point where, my time investment in that is very, very little. And that's the important thing about systems. And I guess with experience and, having done quite a few now, you can refine the steps in the systemized process that are not as efficient as they could be or not getting the ideal results as they could be. And you work to refine that over time. But I think if you go into it with a view of having a system in place, no matter what it is, it could be, let's just say you grocery shopping, if you have a system in place that you're going to do this, this, and this, you can do things a lot more efficiently and save a lot of time. And it applies to everything in life, I think. And so that's been a big plus for the way that we've done things.
Yeah, look, fantastic. And in terms of the day-to-day operations of your practices, once they're up and established, and again, how important the system's been in that as well?
Yeah, in the day-to-day running of the practices, admittedly, my systems are still a work in progress. You know, my first, from 2008, from my first practice to the point we're at now, we basically, you know, have grown 11 practices. So a lot of effort has gone into that. A lot of thinking has gone into that. And now I'm kind of taking a step back from the growth process in terms of expansion to focusing on the internal systems within the practice. Yeah. And those have kind of evolved themselves from the back of my practice managers and their knowledge. But now we're getting, you know, obviously professionals like you involved who are much better at that kind of thing. That you know, being up front is not a strength of mine. So that's something that I'm more than happy to get outside help in. And
well, it speaks to your point earlier about, you know, playing to your strengths, really, doesn't it?
Definitely, that's cool.
What, you know, as you've gone through this whole process, Nove, yeah, and again for those people listening, there would have been a couple of key lessons which obviously we've covered off there. Is there anything else, any other insights, any other awarenesses, any other key ahas, or, you know, pennies dropping? I can't think of any other metaphors to roll off my tongue any faster than that. But is there anything else that, you know, you think that an aspiring practice owner should really think about as they're, you know, contemplating that journey?
Yeah, I think one story that I think I want to share is a situation that I was in when I had my first practice. I bought the first practice. It was a small one-chair practice. Yeah, we got to the point where we got quite busy about 9 months after I'd bought it. It had reached its capacity, so we really needed to add a second chair. But for me at the time, a second chair was going to be roughly a $50,000 investment. And you know, back then I'd spent around $280,000 buying my practice, and $50,000 more. That was a lot of money. I mean, $50,000, a lot of money anytime, but it was a massive amount of money. And for me, it was also, other than the initial investment, I was also going to hire another dental assistant. I was going to hire another dentist. And the dentist that I was looking at the time was recommended by a friend, and she had a pretty busy public job, and she was wanting to get into private practice. And for me, it was like, you know, if I put this second chair in, is she going to be busy? Am I going to waste my 50 grand? And, you know, there was a lot of sleepless nights around that. So one night I was at dinner at a very close friend's house, whose dad owns, just recently sold the third biggest battery company in Australia. And, you know, this guy is very well versed in business. And he said to me, oh, I know if you look a bit concerned, there's something on your mind, you're not your usual chirpy self. And I said to him that, you know, I explained the situation as I just have. And yeah, he said to me, and it's so profound at that time, you know, it will seem so simple, but that, at that time it was a big lesson for me. And he said, no, how much do you charge when you pull a tooth out? I was like, oh, around $200 or so. And he said, 50 grand, lease repayments. That's what, about $500-$600 a month. And I said, yeah. And he said, pull three teeth out and you've paid off your lease repayments. Do you think you're going to do well? And I, you know, obviously that's a really simplified thing, and there's no return on investment lesson in that. There's a lot more to it. But when he broke it down like that, someone in business who had years of experience, when they broke it down to the fact that forget about the 50,000, think about the repayment on the 50,000, think about how much units of labor or how many products you have to sell to break even on that. It just became such an easy decision. And, you know, we put the second chair in within 3 or 4 months. It was booked out and we're ready to expand again. But, you know, I think the massive lesson from that is this: the difference between us as dentists and business owners generally in their ability to think about problems. And, you know, I urge people that are looking at ownership to get an idea of things like return on investment, to get an idea of, you know, just little things like this that will make decisions that are supposed to be difficult or that appear difficult much, much easier. And I think that was very profound for me. And I tell that story a lot, actually.
Yeah, look, it's a cracking story. I really like it, Nove. And again, one of the things that's coming up for me as I'm listening to you speak or share that story with us is the difference, in my view, between traditional practice ownership, which I think is really an owner-operator kind of model, versus true business ownership. And they're two different models. You know, one may not be necessarily more bright than the other, but two very different skill sets in my mind. Do you have any views around... you know, what are your thoughts around traditional business ownership, you know, or traditional practice ownership versus, you know, true business ownership? Do you have any comments around that?
Yeah, I think for me personally, I mean, I'm very pro, as you've probably gathered, pro the second thing, which is the business ownership model. The traditional practice ownership model for a startup in today's environment, especially in most major metro cities, you know, I'll make the statement, it will be controversial, 98% of people that take that sort of approach to it will fail. I completely believe that with everything I have. The ones that will succeed, you know, the 1% or 2% that will succeed will probably have an established base already, will be bringing that into their startup and have some extraordinary skills as a dentist, so offering very niche type services. They'll be the one to succeed. Now, traditional practice ownership involved very little marketing. Yep. It involved perhaps one associate, but it involved the dentist doing the bulk of the dentistry. It involved opening hours of, you know, 9 till 4 every day, Fridays off, playing golf, not even dreaming of being open weekends, that kind of thing. And I think that there was a place for that. There was definitely a place for that because that's how every dentist was. But if you try that sort of model with very little to no marketing, relying on word of mouth as a startup in any of the metro cities in this day and age, it's definitely not going to work for you. I mean, my view is obviously very strong. It's quite polarizing, but yeah, that's how I think of it.
Look, I happen to share very similar views to you. I have a view that, you know, in the years to come, those practices that succeed are going to combine really what it means to be a great health professional, and combine that with the very best in terms of business knowledge and business skills and business acumen. And in the past, again, coming back to your comment about, you know, trying to have the 9 to 4, you know, Monday to Thursday practice in today's world in a metro area, the reason it was so successful in the past, or able to be successful in the past, was purely because there was an undersupply of dentists. And
yes,
as things have tightened up, and we all know the situation around the market at the moment, really, those dentists that don't change, don't grow, don't develop their business thinking, their business skills, I think are really going to suffer. I think it's incumbent on everyone to learn how to be a better business owner, not just a better owner operator.
No, definitely. Just want to clarify one point, Jesse, that the 9 to 4 thing that I mentioned, or the 9 to 5, you know, I think that a lot of dentists, once they establish themselves, I was talking in respect to a startup, but there's a lot of established dentists out there that have had a following for 10, 15, 20 years that can afford to work those hours, and their patients, you know, will move hell and high water to come and see them during those hours, and they're fairly well booked up working those hours. You know, it could be just 2 or 3 days a week, but yeah, I was talking more in the context of a startup, that if you're starting up trying to go into it with those hours, it's going to be quite difficult for you to establish a good patient base. That was just one example.
Yeah, no, absolutely agree. One of the things that people who don't know you so well or haven't seen much of your stuff around the traps, or even those who have, they might not realise that you're an extraordinarily good poker player. And this probably shouldn't come as a surprise as we're listening to the conversation when you think about it. But I was wondering, can you give us a bit of an insight, or, you know, tell us a bit about your poker? You know, I know you've played some tournaments, and I know you've had some astoundingly good wins there. Talk us through a bit about that. How did you get into poker? What was it that attracted you to poker?
I think poker came from back in the uni days, you know, late nights procrastinating instead of studying, switching on the TV and watching poker games, and I guess getting addicted to the strategies and the suspense and everything that was involved with that. And you know, I guess my first throw of the dice with the real money was one night at a casino. There was a bunch of mates and I went to the casino in Brisbane Treasury, and I had $100, which, you know, $100 for me was an astronomical amount of money at that, you know, as a student. Mm. And for us, they, you know, I was with some friends, and they kind of egged me on to have a go. You know, they knew I was a bit interested. We'd played a few fun games together as friends. And so I whacked this $100 down, and I thought, oh, yeah, he'll give it a go. And, you know, 3 or 4 hours later with the friends on the rail sort of, backing me on, and the rest of it, I kind of walked away with $1,100 that night, which, you know, if $100 is an astronomical amount of money, you can imagine how much $1,100 was.
Yep.
And the funny thing was, when I got better at poker, got more experience and started playing in bigger tournaments, I looked back at my play that night and some of the key hands that came up, and I realized just how badly I played them and how lucky I'd actually gotten. And, you know, it was a good sort of reality check. But for me, I guess, you know, that's what spurred it on. If I had lost that initial time, I don't know if I ever would have played again. But, you know, that certainly piqued my interest. Just a continuation from that story. The very next week, I went and lost that entire $1,000 playing poker. So, but, you know, I was hooked from that point on.
Yeah, gamble responsibly, people. just for the sake of the disclaimer, okay. Interesting, though, no, because what I'm really interested in is understanding the parallels between poker playing and business. And sure. I'm sure there's got to be some good lessons in there. And yeah, tell us a bit about the relationship of risk. You know, tell me what your thoughts are around that.
Yeah, so I guess with poker in my very, very initial days, it was still while I was at uni. You know, that first story was very early on in uni, and then it evolved a bit. I played a lot of poker through uni when I first graduated as a dentist, and you know, I've been playing a lot since. But the key thing was, back then, I didn't understand risk, and I didn't understand risk to the extent that I needed to. You know, I lost a lot of money initially, like a lot of people that first get into poker do. When I say a lot in the context of, you know, my personal situation at the time. Yeah. But I think I wasn't understanding risk. So here I was putting a lot of money in, you know, $100, like I said, for me was a massive amount of money at that stage. That's probably all the money I had in my wallet. And it was completely irresponsible of me to have gambled that $100 that night. You know, it turned out to be good. But I guess, you know, with risk as a new practice owner or as someone starting out in ownership, I think it's really important to have a good financial backing and understand that, you know, starting a practice is a massive risk. And the more financial, I guess, backing you have under you, the more savings you have, the less of a risk it becomes. And, you know, when I got into, as I said to you, when I between my first and second practices, there was almost 3 years of gap. And that was because I was establishing a really sound financial base, such that once that was established, I'd had my second practice and the cash flow was there, I could afford to take risks. And, you know, last year we started, I think, four practices in the 1 year. And four practices in 1 year is a massive risk, but it's a calculated risk. It was a risk that, you know, I found some really good areas and they just happened to be at the same time. And they've all turned out really well and things have gone well. But, you know, taking that risk without calculating the risks and without understanding the forces or the different dimensions around that risk could have been catastrophic. But, you know, it paid off. But in the end, it was still a risk.
So what I'm hearing you say is, for those guys contemplating practice ownership, be sure to make sure you're not betting the house or betting the farm in one play. Don't put your whole life on the line for this practice. Make sure if that's what you need to do to start up, would you suggest delaying it for a little while? No.
Yeah, there's a lot of strategies. Delaying, looking, considering a partnership. Yeah. There's, you know, financing a greater portion of it, getting outside investors. There's a lot of different things you can do to ensure that even if the practice doesn't turn out well, that, you know, your personal life remains strong.
Yeah, so you're minimizing your exposure.
Yes, exactly right.
Cool. Yeah. So when you're playing a hand of poker and, you know, it is, as you indicated, a game of unknowns, you don't know what everyone else has got. What filters do you have in place for thinking, okay, I'm going to play this hand or not? You know, what's the decision-making process that you go through?
Yeah, I think it's actually a really interesting question. I was thinking about this the other day in terms of the parallels between poker and business, I guess, generally. But, you know, when you're playing a hand, poker is known as a game of unknowns, so incomplete information. I know the hand I have. I don't know the hand of anyone else at the table. I know the cards the dealers placed in front of us all, they call the community cards. And the only information I have about a particular player's hands is how they act on those hands. So any physical mannerisms that that player may display when they've got a strong hand, stuff I commit to memory, you know. So a lot of times a player plays a hand a certain way, goes to what we call showdown. So in the end, the players remaining in the pot reveal their hands, and that allows you to see what they've got. But what you try to commit to memory is the way they played the hand, their betting characteristics, you know, how much they bet, how quickly they bet, any physical characteristics, did their breathing increase, all that kind of thing. And combining all that and committing it to memory, next time you play a hand against that player, especially if they're not a highly skilled player, you get an idea of, you know, a shortened range. So although you might not know their specific hand, you kind of get an idea of the strength of their hand and you can make your bets accordingly. So I think the parallel to that in business is simply that business is also a game of incomplete information. You know, you don't know how the future is going to go. You don't know how a particular, you know, marketing thing is going to go for you. You know, basically that you're interested in marketing a certain way, but you don't know the result of that marketing. But by researching and finding out about different aspects of that marketing venture that you want to embark on, you get a good idea of how it's going to respond. So even if the worst case scenario comes about, you kind of, in anything in business, you kind of have a good grasp of it and you can control it a lot more. So I think the big lesson is research and information. The more that you've got, the less catastrophic the unknowns become. And so for me, you know, if I've gotten a player in poker where, you know, it's quite a large pot and I've determined that the player doesn't have the best hand, then there's two ways I can win that. I can win that pot from betting high and him folding. But if I know that I've got a better hand than him, then I want him to commit more money to the pot. So because of the information that I've gained through previous hands and the way that that player's played that hand, it can really allow me to control the situation a lot better. And I think in business, it's important that you have control of any situation that you're in and it's not just left to chance. So, yeah.
And have you, interestingly, around this, Nova, I mean, that's fascinating because it is such a study of the human condition and psychology and not just the psychology, but the physiology, that all those things that go with it. But have you found those, I'm just curious to know, the random question, have you found those poker skills translating in any way, you know, like, for instance, negotiating leases or anything like that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I have a lot of friends that I help, friends and colleagues that I help around negotiating. And the thing about negotiating is, you know, you hear the term used all the time in normal life and business, and it's, you know, just call his bluff. So a lot of the time when I'm negotiating with a potential landlord, you know, I think back to poker and I kind of, you know, I've gained a wealth of knowledge from my poker playing days and applying that to business and knowing, you know, based on the actions that they've done, whether they're serious about a certain offer, whether they've reached their limit, or whether you've got more room to negotiate, all that kind of thing. I think playing poker really allows you to get conditioned in the process of negotiation. And there's a lot of times in business where negotiations, you know, happen. So I think it's helped a lot, you know, dealing with staff, dealing with other people that you do business with and everything. So, yeah, it's been quite good in that way as well, I think.
Oh, fantastic. Remind me not to get into too many negotiations, mate. Another question I have for you relating to poker is, you know, you've got your hand there and, you know, you've used all your best intelligence, you've tried to, you know, understand what the other players are doing, and surely there must come a time though when you've got to take that leap of faith, you've got to take a chance and either reveal your cards or fold or whatever it happens to be.
Mm-hmm.
What's your thoughts about, you know, taking a chance, stepping into the unknown?
Yeah, I think for me personally, I mean, I've got a personality that's quite happy to take on risk, especially if I've calculated the worst case and I'm happy with the worst case. So what I mean by that is, you know, I won't get into a situation where I'll take a risk on something where I feel the return is not going to be something that makes me very happy, or where the loss is going to be something that makes me alarmingly unhappy. You know, from that point of view, poker's helped, and getting back to the hand-specific situation that you talked about. The other important thing around that, though, is in poker, like in life, you can play a hand perfectly. So, you know, at the end of the day, as I got more experience with poker, I used to concentrate a lot on results. So I used to think, okay, you know, that day I lost a lot of money, so I must have played really badly. Whereas because of the luck element in poker, you can have a situation where you play perfect poker all day, you make all the perfect decisions, you read play as well, but the hands just and the cards just don't fall your way. And the problem that I find with people in life is that, you know, you could work hard at a particular job and you know, you might not get that promotion, for argument's sake. And they read too much into that. So they start to think that, oh, I'm a failure, I didn't do things properly. And they try to learn a lesson where there's no lesson to be learned. And the important thing with poker as I got more experience was realizing that I wasn't, you know, my wife and I used to go and stay in hotels. I used to come back. And the first question she would ask me is how did you go? And my answer in the early days of playing poker was, you know, how I went financially, if I'd lost money, how I went. But as I got more experience, the answer became more about how I played. So the money was inconsequential. You know, I could have lost a lot of money and played perfect poker, but I was more happy with myself because I played perfect poker. In poker, they say there's a 30% skill element and there's a 70% luck element. In life, there's a much, much smaller luck element. But the thing about luck is, if I play the best poker I possibly can, everyone's luck in the long run will equal out. It's the skill element that will differentiate us. And in life, as I said, there's even a smaller luck element. So as long as you keep doing things the right way, as long as in business you keep making the correct decisions, and just because they don't turn out well for you, you know, this time around, it doesn't mean that they won't. And a lot of the time, you know, when things don't go well, people try to learn a lesson when there's no lesson to be learned. You know, if you think you've done the right thing and you can analyze things and assess that you have and things haven't gone your way, well, you can put that down to a bit of unluckiness in that particular situation instead of learning a lesson that's not meant to be learned. So, yeah, I think that's important.
Look, that's a really good point. And in spite of previous conversations that we've had around luck, I think we are on the same page. I just also have a view that the harder I work, the luckier I get. And one of the comments that I would make about luck just on that, and I think you've already covered it anyway, is doing the right thing consistently. Putting in the work. And, you know, one of the things I find when it comes to luck is people will blame bad luck when really it could have been lack of preparation, lack of training, lack of whatever it happens to be. So while I know that you attribute a portion of your success to, you know, having the cards fall the right way, I also find that there are some people who attribute their poor results to, you know, factors beyond their control when the reality is, in my view, there were plenty of things that they could have done to improve their odds of winning. It kind of goes both ways. Of course, we're probably singing from the same song sheet there, mate. What I'd really love to just understand, just as we wrap up the conversation around poker, is the concept of, you know, when you play poker, you get dealt a certain, you know, certain set of cards, a hand, you know, obviously those are the cards that you play with. And same in life, you know, we all get dealt a certain hand that we play. Do you have any view about, you know, making the best of what you've got, you know, finding the enjoyment or finding the good in what there is already? It's perhaps a little philosophical conversation perhaps, but or even how do you change the cards if you can in life?
Yeah, I think my view might be a little more contrarian to most people. So in, you know, just going back to poker,
certainly not, mate.
we basically, the best players or the players that do the best in poker are the players that play the least hands. So what I mean by that is, you know, a good day of poker playing, typically you should be folding or getting rid of between 80 and 90% of your hands. So, you know, you should only be playing with 10 or 20% of your hands. So I think, you know, the application to that in life and in opportunities is, I've had a lot of people that come to me and they 2 months ago they made the decision that they wanted to look into practice ownership, and all of a sudden they've got a practice to buy and it's the one their heart is set on. It's the very first practice they looked at, and there's nothing good about that practice other than the fact that they think that there's no other practices out there and this is the one for them. And I think, you know, in poker, the most successful players are only playing with 10 to 20% of the hands that they have. Whereas, yeah, and I think in business, there's a lot of opportunities that walk through the door. You know, you get 20 reps see you in a year's time trying to sell their products. You know, there should only be a very small percentage of products that you actually buy. The same way as a new practice owner, you might have 10, 20 different locations come at you, but it's about being patient and about sticking to what you know, sticking to... I guess a set of principles that will guide how you look at a different opportunity. So, for example, in my talks on the weekend, I went through location selection and gave the attendees an idea of what makes a perfect location. And if they follow that, I'm convinced that they have half the battle won in respect to choosing a location. But the issue with following that is there's going to be many locations that come at them that they're going to have to just refuse and just say, no, that's not good. That's not a good location. My practice is going to be on the back foot from day one if I start in that area. And I think, yeah, poker and life have a lot of parallels, and that's yet another one, I think.
Yeah, look, that's a fantastic story, and if I can just build on that for a moment, one of my very earliest business mentors from back when I was in my 20s, early on, used to say to me, you know, Jesse, the opportunity of a lifetime comes along about once a week, and you know, you're going to need to learn to say no to the things, and this is a comment that, again, we kind of discussed on the forum in an abstract way last night, but... it's about designing a life where you have some filters where, you know, most of the stuff that comes across your desk, you're going to have to refuse. And it seems to me that's the same way with poker as well, is, you know, you're going to carefully select the hands. You're going to, you know, pick a handful of them, play them, and leave the rest. And I really think that one of the problems that dentists have is we tend to, as a rule, dentists tend to bounce around like pinballs looking from one opportunity to the next.
And it's a problem.
Yeah.
And in poker, you know, when I get impatient and play a hand that I should really let go of, that's when problems arise. You know, that's when I can lose all my money and things like that. And I think the practical application of that is if you get bored of waiting, you start to take more risks. And a lot of those risks are unnecessary risks. So it's really important that being patient is a lesson, I think.
Which is a beautiful segue into cricket. Which is really random, I know. But look, yeah, I know you're a cricket fan and I am too. But, you know, I was just thinking as you're describing that, it reminds me of Glenn McGrath bowling ball after ball after ball, just, you know, short of a good length, you know, just outside off stump. And the batsman, he's boring the batsman into taking a risk, right?
Yes,
and
exactly,
it's exactly
right.
Exactly the thing. And then they do something rash and, you know, all of a sudden they're caught in the slips and bingo, he's got his wicket. So, you know, from batsman's point of view, it's about shot selection. And the same thing in poker, same thing in business. It's all about waiting for the right opportunity and capitalizing on it when it approaches. And being
when it does come.
Yeah, and being prepared for it too.
Yeah, and even Glenn McGrath, as good as he was, you know, if you were a patient batsman, he is going to bowl a bad ball. But I guess the beauty of Glenn McGrath was he had the batsman in such a defensive mindset that they were just gun-shy. So he would get away with the odd bad ball because they just weren't ready to capitalize on the opportunity that he presented when it came. So I guess the other parallel from that is to ensure that, you know, although you've had a run of bad luck, all these bad locations have come across your desk and none of them have been good. When the right one comes along, make sure you're using the same filter so that you can actually see that it's the right opportunity. So, yeah, I think there's a lot to it with all sports, I guess, and business.
Fantastic. Hey, listen, Nov, look, I just wanted to say thank you so much for coming on the show tonight. It's been an absolute pleasure having you here, mate, and sharing all your lessons, all your wisdom and all your insights over the last, you know, how many years you've had in this business and starting those 11 practices. There's so much more that we could go into, but we might save that for another episode. But again, mate, on behalf of all the listeners here tonight, thanks so much for being so generous with your time. Really appreciate it, mate. You're a gem.
No, thanks a lot, Jesse. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks very much.
Cool. Thanks, mate. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/podcast. And to discover how you can go large with your practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.